All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday. Yay. It's Friday, July 14th, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. It is a cloudy, humid, and warm 75 degrees here in upstate New York. We're pretty soggy. It's been days and days of rain. And now the heat. Welcome to mid-July. So where do we leave off on Wednesday? We titled the show, AI Wins, Humans Lose, China Kicks Our Ass. And that's about what it ends up as. Find out that China and all kinds of cities in China, not just universities, but individual provinces and regions, are offering millions of dollars of grant money to get the best and the brightest in these disruptive technologies to set up shop in their community. And it's very competitive right now, and people are choosing, instead of coming to the United States, of going to China and working on some of these technologies. A lot of this stuff is in warfare, swarm, surveillance, this type of stuff. So it's pretty frightening to think about what a potential future could hold. We did find out there's a lot of investment going on as well into AI between Google, and Google's launching their big venture capitalist arm to fund AI startups, as well as farming out their AI engineering staff to other companies to get the tentacles on board and help them, quote unquote, develop AI for their business. We have a full-blown takeover of AI in every portion of our lives in the future. I just saw, too, recently that Microsoft was now investing very hugely in AI. They'd been working on that for a while. And, the Microsoft Research forms a new AI unit. Let me see if I can find that. Microsoft is forming a grand army of experts in artificial intelligence wars with Google, Facebook, and Amazon. Artificial intelligence is fast becoming the next major battlefield between Silicon Valley's biggest companies, and Microsoft is putting its troops in formation. This is the battle of the tech giants in SimWar. How many consumers can you get and how much data can you take? This is pretty crazy. On Wednesday morning, and this was a few days ago, Microsoft announced the creation of Microsoft Research AI, a dedicated unit within its global Microsoft Research division that will focus exclusively on how to make the company's software smarter now and in the future. Make no mistake, Microsoft has long employed a veritable army of AI experts who have contributed their expertise to products and services, including Microsoft Translator, Microsoft Cortana Digital Assistant, ding, and even the infamous rogue Tay, the chatbot. Gotta love Tay. The difference now, Microsoft Research Lab Director Eric Horvitz tells Business Insider, is that this new organization will bring roughly 100 of those experts under one figurative roof. And by bringing them together, Horvitz says, Microsoft's AI team can do more faster, he says. Just what we need. Horvitz describes the formation of Microsoft Research AI as a key strategic effort, a move that is absolutely critical as artificial intelligence becomes increasingly important in the future of all technology. All in all, Microsoft's Research AI encompasses about one-tenth of the staff of the overall Microsoft Research Group with plans to grow. Plus, Microsoft is taking steps to make sure that AI is being used responsibly. Thanks, Microsoft, Billy Gates. Thanks to a new overseeing ethics board called Ether, AETHER, made up of top Microsoft execs from across the company. And a new design guide will provide Microsoft teams with insight into how to responsibly develop and deploy AI. Bill Gates' dream coming true. Duh, duh, duh. Horvitz says that the formation of this group speaks to Bill Gates' original vision for Microsoft Research when it was founded back in 1991. Microsoft's famous mission at the time was a personal computer on every desk in every home. But Gates wanted to go a step further so those same computers could see you, hear you, and talk to you. And that was a vision that drew Horowitz to Microsoft in the first place when he was a freshly minted PhD in 1993. Now with AI getting better day by day, he's a key player in the push to get it the rest of the way there. Well, he sees it differently than I do. And a lot of Microsoft's AI priorities draw on the original version from Microsoft co-founders Bill Gates and Paul Allen, says Horowitz. Indeed, in the long term, Microsoft Research AI is making it a major goal to build quote-unquote general AI, which is the holy grail for artificial intelligence researchers. While current systems like Microsoft Cortana or Amazon Alexa seem intelligent, they can only really say what they've been programmed to say, and a general AI would think and reason like a human. Sooner than that, Microsoft is really focused on applying AI to the tools that customers already use. Horowitz cites an internal presentation he recently attended about how Excel spreadsheets might be smart enough to catch formula errors before you make them. He calls this augmented human cognition. And the evidence that Microsoft is on the right track can be found with the company's success at using its bots to beat high scores in games like Ms. Pac-Man, one I was never good at. It's fun to compete and be at the top of the charts for these games and challenge problems, but now it's really time to double down and bring this tech to products people actually use. But the ethical dilemma, where does this leave us? Well, technology is only part of the problem, and as any AI expert will tell you, there's a tremendous potential for AI systems to go terribly wrong, not just the Skynet kill all humans kind of way, but also more insidious ways like manipulating people to spend more money or choosing which groups of humans to kill in a self-driving car accident. I foresaw that a long time ago. Artificial intelligence carries a lot of power and a lot of responsibility. That's why Microsoft has also announced the formation of Ether, the AI and Ethics and Engineering and Research, a board of executives drawn from across every division of the company, including lawyers. Ding-a-ling. The idea, says Horowitz, is to spot issues and potential abuses of AI before they start, and in his model that he hopes is adopted by others. Microsoft's AI design guide is designed to help engineers build systems that augment what humans can do without making them feel, they're actually going to say it, obsolete. Otherwise, people might start to feel like machines are piloting them rather than the other way around. And that is what is so key about the whole psychological game they're playing. They're dangling carrots to apps like Cortana that feel warm and relatable. Oh my goodness, those computers better talk to us in a way that's friendly and approachable, says Microsoft General Manager Emma Williams, in charge of the group behind the design guide. As people, we have the control, she says, or you just think it. Microsoft isn't the only one thinking in this direction. Google, too. Oh, let's all get on board. In China, just launched a cross-company design group called People Plus AI Research, or PAIR, cutesy little acronym, to keep its teams thinking in the same way. And that's the kind of thing that's fine by Horowitz, who sees it as critical and pre-competitive for these tech titans to work together to make sure AI is being responsibly built and make them the good guys. Once that's settled, then they can go back to fighting tooth and nail for the future of the technology. And then they try to get standards or whatever, but pretty interesting. Microsoft and Google are going to control Skynet, as well as the military-industrial complex, DARPA, all the Ivy League colleges. So something else I was reading today, how to prepare your kids for AI, the singularity, and other future issues. This got my attention. This is out of a publication called Fatherly, fatherly.com. How to prepare kids for AI, the singularity, and other future issues. The future is sprinting to your doorstep. machine learning expert, artificial intelligence specialist, and author of The Curiosity Cycle, Jonathan Muggan wants your children to be prepared for the robot-fueled world ahead. You saw The Terminator. You know what happens when you sit around playing arcade games and listening to Use Your Illusion 2 instead of preparing for Skynet. But Muggan isn't worried about Arnold. He's not even concerned about a Westworld-like event where sentient creations rise up and go all snap, snap, spurt, spurt on their makers. Oh, no. Rather, he's worried that humans will be made useless when the singularity that owes a fun point when computers surpass humans appears. We're getting close. Tech already makes people feel inferior. Alexis, how do I tie my shoes? What skills you should be teaching your children to have a fighting chance in a future dominated by robots? Muggan says it's about honing the skills that robots won't have, namely curiosity and creativity. But that's not always true. Just wait, there's more. And showing your kids where the off switch is usually located won't hurt either. Except there won't be an off switch. It'll be in the ether. How to understand the coming threat. Yes, the singularity sounds something out of a mediocre 80s science fiction film, but Muggan says the first part in preparing for it is to understand that it is not some leather jacket wearing Saturday afternoon movie fiction, but it is inevitable fact. I think of the singularity as the point when computers become smarter than humans, explains Muggan, and that is about where it is. And they get smarter every year, and we stay about the same, so they will pass us at some point. We found out the other day that Google, I believe it was Google, was teaching its AI to build more AI, so the machine was improving the machine and out creating the company's engineers. That's frightening. So one of the newest things for the future of artificial intelligence and deep learning is to start training AI as if it were a child. And how treating robots like children is changing AI. For the most part, robotic technologies are still in their infancy. This was from 2015, but accelerate that exponentially. Even the most sophisticated automata are literal toddlers stumbling and tumbling as they make their way through the world they can't yet understand. Maybe that is why some artificial intelligence researchers have begun to treat their creations like infants, teaching them as one might teach a baby, letting them learn through every stumble and tumble that once held them back. This is a story Jack Clark tells in a thoroughly reported story for Bloomberg Businessweek. Clark focuses primarily on the University of California Berkeley lab of Peter Abeel, where researchers have set up what amounts to a nursery for a robot known as Brett, resembling, quote, a cross between a toaster and a George Foreman grill. Brett, the name is short for Berkeley Robot for the Elimination of Tedious Tasks, has learned to interact with its environment by playing with the kind of toys you might find in a preschool. Remember, once we give him robot googly eyes. The photographs in Clark's story show Brett manipulating large Lego bricks, toy airplanes, and more. And as it does so, it is literally learning how things fit together. And what's more is that it is doing so under its own steam, apparently receiving only the most general directions from its human handlers, as it's teaching itself through trial and error. This patina of childhood exploration and discovery belies the real complexity of the project. Clark explains that Brett functions through a sophisticated combination of deep learning and reinforcement learning. Deep learning, a technology that has been widely applied by AI researchers, helps Brett perceive and make sense of its surroundings. As Slate's David Abrash wrote, when discussing Google's application of this technology, deep learning, quote, doesn't actually have all that much to do with human learning. In this case, it is a neural network that can iteratively rewrite itself as it works to solve a problem. Reinforcement learning, Clark explains, trains the robot to improve its approach to tasks through repeated attempts. It's a bit closer to the way children learn. He says that Abiel was partially inspired by child psychology tapes in which, quote, young children constantly adjust their approaches when solving tasks. According to Clark, Brett fuses these two systems in a novel fashion, and it is not, however, the first time that someone has at least imagined the possibility of educating AI simply by creating it. One revealing, if little discussed, example appears in Richard Powers' 1995 metafiction novel Galatea 2.2, a retelling of a Pygmalion story. I don't know what that is. Galatea 2.2 follows a novelist, also named Richard Powers, as he attempts to help a computer make sense of literature by introducing it to a carefully sequenced curriculum of classic works. Teaching a fictional machine how to analyze textual form is, of course, not the same as helping a real one grasp that square pegs don't fit in round holes. Nevertheless, Powers' novel may clarify the scope of a project like Abiel's. In one especially evocative passage, Powers writes that the computer, which acquires the name Helen, was strange. Was stranger than I was capable of imagining. She sped left three free through green eggs and ham, stayed dry-eyed at make way for ducklings, feared not throughout where the wild things are, and so this must have been a sci-fi novel. The symbols of these shameless simulations played on had no heft or weight for her, no real-world reference. Remember, we've read about AI is doing virtualization, like building a virtual reality of events to learn from. And then when they perform it in the real world, they got it on the first attempt. Powers' novel remains a meaningful reminder that artificial intelligence will probably never correspond to human intelligence. Yeah, don't let them fool you. Just because a machine can learn to understand the world doesn't mean it will ever understand that world in the same way that we do. Human children treat their toys as symbols for the real object to which they correspond. Playing with those toys, they anticipate their own future power, even as they develop the power through their play. For Brett, however, Duplo bricks are presumably just Duplo bricks. In other words, it's important to remember that AI and will likely to remain deeply alien. And in this article on Google's Deep Dream, Aubach chastises those who describe what computers do in human terms. A computer that can produce images that look hallucinatory to our eyes, he observes, isn't really hallucinating in any meaningful sense. In fact, the mechanics of the neural networks that drive our most promising AI creations are bound to make them less like us, and even as they seem to become smarter. So, shh, go back to sleep. DARPA's working on teaching AI like children as well, if I remember correctly. And listen to this one. So, Musk's Tesla division, Tesla's new AI guru, could help its cars teach themselves. Self-learning, self-driving cars. Andrei Karpathy, Tesla's new director of AI, will help the company's vehicles teach themselves to drive. This is a June 22nd, 2017 article out of MIT's Technology Review. Elon has hired a new director of AI research at Tesla, and it may signal a plan to rethink the way its automated driving works. Ding, ding. This week, Musk poached Andrei Karpathy, an expert on vision, deep learning, and reinforcement learning from OpenAI, a nonprofit that Musk and others are funding that's dedicated to, quote, discovering and enacting the path to safe artificial general intelligence. Karpathy, who apparently reports directly to Musk, is a rising star in the world of AI, having studied at Stanford with Fifi Li, a leading AI expert who is now the chief scientist of Google Cloud. Li is famous in tech circles for having developed the data set of images that helped inspire breakthrough in machine vision, those robot googly eyes, in the cute pictures. Many have pointed to Karpathy's expertise in computer vision as a key asset to Tesla, and that is true. But his experience with building reinforcement learning systems could be even more important for Tesla's autopilot efforts. Reinforcement learning is inspired by the way animals learn by repeating their behavior that led to a positive outcome. And as we noted earlier this year, it has proven to be a powerful way to train computers to do things that are impossible to program. See 10 breakthrough technologies in 2017, reinforcement learning. This form of a machine learning was at the heart of AlphaGo, which was the computer program from Alphabet's DeepMind that learned to play the ancient board game with superhuman skill. A number of car makers, including Google, Uber, and Mobileye, which was recently acquired by Intel, are looking to reinforcement learning as the way to have cars figure out for themselves, in a simulation, like I was saying, virtual reality, how to drive in challenging situations. Think of a four-way stop or a busy intersection. It is incredibly challenging to write the rules for a car to navigate such a situation. But through reinforcement learning, it might be possible for a self-driving car to learn how to do this for itself. After Stanford, Karpathy interned with DeepMind at Google, where reinforcement learning is a major focus and the technique is also a big theme at OpenAI. In fact, in a lengthy post about reinforcement learning on his own blog, Karpathy mentions reinforcement learning in the context of Tesla's autopilot. He also notes that reinforcement learning does not generally scale well to situations where experimentation is costly, new approaches combined with lots of real-world data, which is the kind that Tesla is collecting, may help. So appointing Karpathy as Tesla's director of AI research indicates something else about the challenges of autonomous driving, that there is some distance left to go before it is solved. And now there's another story that says, what to know before you get into a self-driving car. It's insane. I can't even believe this is where we're at, people. So we had started a story somewhere about what to teach your kids about dealing with a future full of AI and the singularity and other future issues. Oh, it's insane. So here's the next section, understanding the coming threats. Yes, the singularity sounds like something out of a mediocre 1980 science fiction film, but Muggins says the first part in preparing for it is understanding that it is not some leather jacket wearing Saturday afternoon movie fiction, but it is an inevitable fact. I think of the singularity as the point when computers become smarter than humans, explains Muggins. They get smarter every year, and we stay about the same, so they will pass us at some point. We are already heading in this direction. Think about how many tasks robots already take on, then tell you what route to take home, what investments to make, what fast food is within the closest proximity to your mouth. And as robots start to run more of society, we humans may no longer understand how large parts of our environment work. This scenario seems both impossible and inevitable. The faster you accept this, the better, because if you feel like the singularity is a joke, ding, ding, so will your kids, and then they'll be more dependent on AI than any other previous generation. What your four-year-old has that a robot doesn't, acceptance is the first step. Muggins says fostering your child's curiosity and creativity is vital for the next step toward preparing them for the future. Tech does two things. It makes our environment change faster, and it gives us more options. Curiosity will be necessary to keep up with tech's challenges. Creativity will allow a child to leverage the additional options provided by technology changing the environment. In other words, robots might be able to lift thousands of pounds, perform complex computations in milliseconds, and call up the sum of human knowledge, but it'll take a long time until they truly are able to create that. And the curiosity needed to reach such creativity will separate your children from the circuit board brained. Wah, wah, wah. So they're saying, let them merge, let them merge. Arming them with skills, you're already teaching your children to be curious and creative. That's not the point. It's about how you will do that to give them the mental agility to stand a chance. How awful is this? Talk through the environment. This is the old parenting trick of making the extraordinary look ordinary. For example, the grocery store might not seem exciting. There was a time when humans had to grow all their food and hunt or kill animals in order to avoid starvation. Now you simply walk into a store and buy food, plus whatever Twinkies are classified as, in a line of thought that allows them to realize that things were not always this line of thought allows them to realize things were not always this way. These are beginnings, endings, and evolutions. Normalizing this type of thinking is important. So then show them what hucksters look like. Mugen says that you should begin to teach your kids to understand that they are being tricked at times and how it's being done because robots will be crafty buggers. He uses TV as an example. Point out what tricksters use to advertise to get you to buy things you don't need. I did that very early on. And have your child point out the ones that he or she thinks that they are using. Like, oh, they're playing fun music and showing bright colors and making this look more entertaining. Exactly there, Jenny. Or, do bikini models make burgers actually taste better, Daddy? That's hysterical. And then search the space of possible actions. In general, Muggins says that the right kind of curiosity to deal with what's ahead comes from, quote, searching the space of possible actions. I've talked about that. All the possible timelines. Kids often stumble when faced with a problem because they are trying to jump right to the answer. But countering this impulse will be the key in the coming decades. The singularity might not happen for many, many years. I doubt it, though. But you already see AI encroaching on daily life, taking jobs and lowering wages, and maybe robots will even fight you for entertainment. And like in that Hugh Jackman movie where he's not Wolverine. Ding. The point is, your kids may not be leading a resistance of human freedom fighters, but they still need to be armed with nimble thinking to set them apart from the computer, or else, like I said, the game is over. This isn't a joke. You know, I like to kind of joke about this stuff because that's how I deal with it, but this really isn't a joke. It's frightening. So, do you arm them and let them merge? That's the conclusion that Musk came to. Or do you try to, I don't know, keep them pure so they don't fall victim? It's definitely a difficult decision. So China's outsmarting us. We found out they are working on swarm intelligence. The singularity is coming. And there was an article from June 20th, 2017 out of sciencemag.org, which is a science publication. Computer chip mimics human brain with light beams for neurons. Artificial neural networks, computer algorithms that take inspiration from the human brain, have demonstrated fancy feats such as detecting lies. Remember, we talked about those micro expressions. Recognizing faces, 230-point facial recognition, and predicting heart attacks. And that was a brand new one that just came out in arrhythmia. But computers can't run them efficiently. Now a team of engineers has designed a computer chip that uses beams of light to mimic neurons. Such optical neural networks could make any application of so-called deep learning, from virtual assistants to language translators, many times faster and more efficient. It works brilliantly, says Daniel Brunner, a physicist at the Fimoto.st Institute at Besançon, France, which I'm sure is some kind of maybe CERN or something, who was not involved in the work. But I think the really interesting things are yet to come. Most computers work by using a series of transistors, gates, that allow electricity to pass or not pass. But decades ago, physicists realized that light might make certain processes more efficient. For example, building neural networks. That's because light waves can travel and intersect in parallel, allowing them to perform lots of functions simultaneously. It's like old school optical. Scientists have used optical equipment to build simple neural nets But these setups required tabletops full of sensitive mirrors and lenses, and yeah, fiber was always expensive. For years, photonic processing was dismissed as impractical. Now researchers at Ware, MIT, Cambridge have managed to condense much of that equipment to a microchip just a few millimeters across. Oh my God. This new chip is made of silicon, and it simulates a network of 16 neurons in four layers of four. That's pretty interesting. Data enters the chip in the form of laser beam, split into four small laser beams, and then the brightness of each entering beam signifies a different number or piece of information, and the brightness of each existing beam represents a new number. The solution after this information has been processed in between the paths of light crossed and interact in ways that can amplify or weaken their individual intensities, the same way ocean waves can add or subtract from each other when they cross. Oh, how cool is that? These crossings simulate the way signals from one neuron to another in the brain can be intensified or dampened based on the strength of the connection. And the beams also pass through simulated neurons that further adjust their intensities. Optical computation is efficient because once light rays are generated, they travel and interact on their own. Now that's amazing. If you think of the micro and the macro to space, and really that we are just stardust and all the same elements and chemicals. So who's to say that like energy to light is like not the conversion that makes things more of a longer time frame than what we're aware of, let's say. And now they can actually simulate. This is insane. They can simulate neurons in a 4-bit process, it sounds like. So optical computation is efficient because once light rays are generated, they travel and interact on their own. And you can guide them without energy using a regular glass lens, whereas transistors would require electricity to operate it. The researchers then tested their optical neural network on real-world tasks, recognizing vowel sounds. And when trained on recordings of 90 people making vowel sounds, old-school computers perform the task with relative ease. A computer simulating a 16-neuron network was right 92% of the time. Just a 16-bit network. And when the scientists tested the same data set on the new network, they came surprisingly close with a success rate of 77% when old school was 92%. I don't see how that's close. But of course, faster and more efficiently. They reported this month in the Nature Photonics. Researchers say that they can improve performance with future adjustments. Part of why this is new and exciting is that it uses silicon photonics, which is this new platform for doing optics on a chip, says Alex Tate, an electrical engineer at Princeton University who was not involved in the work. Because it uses silicon, it is potentially low cost, and they are able to use existing foundries to scale it up, right, because it's using laser beams and silicon. Tate and colleagues have also developed a partially optical neural net on a chip, which they plan to publish soon in scientific reports. Once the system includes more neurons and the kinks are worked out, it could supply data centers, autonomous cars, and national security services with neural nets that are orders of magnitude faster than existing designs while using orders of magnitude less power, according to a study of the two primary authors. Just in a tiny little chip. It's crazy. This is insane. Computer chip mimics human brain with beams of light from neurons. We find out light just goes on and ripples forever. So where do we go from here? Teaching robots right from wrong. We found out they're already teaching robots like children, trying to teach them how to come up with ethics and morality. They're already saying AI with human-level intelligence be walking the streets by 2040. And I think that is what will happen when AI creates its own AI, which like Google is already doing. And Tesla cars will be teaching themselves. So there's a couple other things talking about being able to create neurons and simulate brains. But we've also figured out how to program living cells. The evolution of human technology has proceeded in lockstep with the biological evolution of our species. For millions of years, we were content with our primitive Oldowan choppers and our Ildjuian bifaces in Neolithic. We started playing with more sophisticated tools like fire, and in the Bronze and Iron Ages, they followed in quick succession. Now researchers at MIT have developed a programming language that will allow the toolmakers of the future to quote-unquote program living cells, outfitting them with DNA-encoded circuits that confer a host of new functions on the hacked organism. Christopher Voigt, professor of biological engineering at MIT, explains, "It is literally a programming language for bacteria," he says. "You use a text-based language just like you're programming a computer, and then you take that text and you compile it and you turn it into a DNA sequence instead of a mobile phone application that you put into the cell, and then the circuit runs inside of the cell like you've re-encoded it and you're running a sequence." It's just, it's nuts. Essentially, you start with the ability you want to program into the bacterium, say detecting the presence of certain harmful chemicals, and then you write a little program describing it, and a DNA sequence is created that will achieve the desired function. And just like that, you've got a toxin-sniffing germ. The new language, which was described in the April 1st issue of Science, has already been used to create biological circuits that can respond up to three inputs in different ways. And its implications for medical technology, agriculture, and even biological computing are simply staggering. But the real revolutionary aspect of the new programming language is that it can be used by literally anyone. Oh my God. Like they never could have prepared us for the level of apocalypse that is happening right at this moment to the whole world of biology, everything that, like, all the secrets are being cracked right now and being given to too many lunatics to do whatever they want with it. And it's insane. It's insane that there's no real controls. This is really beyond frightening. It says it can be used by literally anyone. And you needn't have any training in genetic or biological engineering. Hell, you don't even need to know what a gene is. It's genetic engineering for the masses, for the stupid masses. The designers even plan to make the language user interface universally available on the internet. Oh, God. You could be a student in high school and go to the web-based server and type out the program you want and spit out a DNA sequence. The designer based their language on Verilog, which is a popular coding language for programming computer chips. The key to making the whole thing work was tailoring the language to the complex conditions within the cell. They had to make computing elements like logic gates that could be slipped into a bacterial genome. Furthermore, the language is easily customizable. Right now, the genetic elements are specialized for DDD, E. coli, good old Georgie Porgy Church's favorite. But researchers are working on a means for allowing designers to write a single code, which then could be translated to fit the genomes of other organisms. Oh, my God. And the speed of the new method means that DNA circuits would normally take years to design and build now require the mere touch of a button. The appearance of this new biological programming language represents something of a game changer. Along with other techniques like CRISPR, it removes evolution, human or otherwise, from the uncertain realm of chance and blind happenstance, and it compresses its timescale from the geologic to a merely day-to-day. It means that we can start to say in our biological destiny that we can likewise control the destinies of the living things with which we share the planet, whether that is too much power and responsibility for any one species to wield. And I would argue that opinion, especially the species prone to some pretty whopping lapses in judgment, such as the human species, it is a discussion for another time, or 500 other Before the First Cup episodes. But in the meantime, the researchers are looking to design practical applications for the technology, including ingestible bacteria, yes, synthetic gut bacteria, we've talked much about that, that can aid in lactose processing, bacteria that can colonize plant roots and generate toxins to ward off insect attacks, and self-regulating yeast strains that automatically shut off when producing harmful byproducts in fermenting reactions. Welcome to the newest technological revolution, the age of living technology. So beyond that, so we can program cells with little code and you don't even need to know anything about anything to be able to do it. We've talked about Craig Venter before. Craig Venter is a venture capitalist. I think he might have been involved in PayPal at one time. And he has been working on sequencing the human genome and then DNA or biological assembly lines and being able to produce. I think he had a project going with DARPA, being able to produce like their living foundries, which were chunks of code, reusable code. Well, Craig Venter, this is from June 15th, 2017, so just a month ago, Craig Venter's digital to biological converter, ding, is real. Right now, it prints proteins, but in the far future, it could print human babies on Mars. I saw something too. I don't have it up, but I'll have to find it. I'm so far behind in my notes. But I was reading something about some new Chinese interstellar quantum internet they were talking about. And I was wondering if it wasn't to be able to broadcast that reality TV show that they wanted to do called Mars when they sent the first humans to Mars and then be able to sell it back here commercially as a TV show. Funny. But this quantum internet, space internet. So anyway, this printing the digital to biological converter that they're talking about, Craig Venter thinks sending living organisms to other galaxies and spaceships is definitely science fiction. He says it is much more realistic to print them on site using digital representations of their genome. He calls this biological teleportation, essentially emailing medicine and organisms back and forth between Earth and other planets, is just one of the far future implications of a device developed by Synthetic Genomics, a company founded by Venter, a superstar geneticist and biotechnologist. The tabletop device is called the Digital to Biological Converter, or DBC for short, and without a fancy box, it looks like a bunch of complicated mechanical crap laid out on a table. The device accepts digital representations of DNA over the internet, oh no, and reconstructs them on the spot using the chemical building blocks of life, adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine. And you might recognize their initials from the movie Gattaca or from Before the First Cup, CATG. We've talked about them quite often. Just like a printer, it needs a cassette, but instead of colors, it is bottles of chemicals. Venter said over the phone, it's packaging complex biology that each of our tiny cells do remarkably well at a much, much smaller scale. Venter, who pioneered genome sequencing in humans, has been at the center of some of the biggest genetic breakthroughs of our time, and he has been teasing the advent of the DBC for years in interviews. And in his 2013 book, Life at the Speed of Light, and along the way, Synthetic Genomics developed a precursor to the DBC called the BioXP, which can construct DNA, but not quite from scratch. After the BioXP was used to quickly synthesize an avian flu vaccine in 2013, Venter says that SpaceX's Elon Musk expressed an interest and using a futuristic DBC to print terraforming bacteria on Mars. Ding, DARPA. Getting antimicrobials and vaccines to space is going to be important and not at the slow pace of rocket ships, says Venter. So now the DBC has become more than just a futuristic curio. With a peer-reviewed paper published this month in Nature Biotechnology, the paper describes the system in detail and lays out some of its successes. It can print DNA, RNA, which is key for decoding DNA instructions, viruses, and some kind of vaccines and bacteriophages to kill infections. It can also print synthetic bacterium developed by Venter last year, which is 437 genes, and it is the simplest life ever, according to him. I remember we covered this story as well. The paper and the attention that Venter hopes it will garner could start a worldwide revolution in medicine if enough people buy into this idea and the dangling carrot of synthetic life all over, and the DBC itself, that is, right now, it has some issues, namely synthesizing DNA with its device in an incredibly wasteful and expensive process. It isn't totally error-proof, but Venter is very optimistic. He said, if you had a DBC hooked up to your desktop computer, we could email you the insulin or vaccine, and the device would produce it for you, ready to go. And if you think about all the protein-based drugs that are out there, if you can get those by email instead of getting them from a pharmacy, is conceptually going to be a totally different world. The idea, as Venter describes it, is for every major hospital, clinic, and the corporation in the world to own a DBC. And if a viral outbreak hits, the vaccine could be sent around the world in a digital file in minutes and produced locally instead of being stockpiled and shipped out. Ding! We could stop pandemics in their tracks, says Venter. Of course, it's about pandemics. I phoned Daniel Gibson, a scientist at Synthetic Genomics, who invented the DNA assembly process known as the Gibson assembly. He was fired up, as Venter, when it came to the near-term medical application of their DBC. But when it came to Venter's far future aspirations in space, he was far more pragmatic and said it's best to not to get too distracted. Venter credits Gibson, interesting name, back from Neuromancer, with much of the nitty-gritty work in developing the digital biological converter. And so Gibson knows exactly how much more work there is to be done before we can print DNA larger than viruses, perhaps even people in space. As DNA constructs are synthesized, about 99.999% of raw materials go to waste. It is incredibly wasteful and expensive, says Gibson. We are trying to solve that. Instead of building two genes with 20 liters of waste, how about building 2,000 genes with just a few milliliters of waste? That will dramatically reduce the cost of DNA synthesis, reduce waste, improve the process, and make it more robust. Synthesizing DNA is also prone to introducing unwanted mutations or accidentally or on purpose. The digital biological converter is described in the Nature paper has pretty well worked out for the size of DNA constructs that it can currently print. But as they move to more complex organisms, the threat of introducing mutations increases. Uh-oh. All it takes is one DNA base to be incorrect for a protein not to work, or a therapeutic not to do what it was supposed to do, or for a cell to not be functional. By getting the digital biological converter to fulfill some of Venter's furthers, a field ideas is going to take all of the tech that synthetic genomics has already developed, as well as a technique that they haven't even thought of yet, says Gibson. Look at how fast we went from the Wright brothers plane to supersonic jets, or from very crude DNA synthesis methods to now doing a human genome on average every 12 to 15 minutes, 24 hours a day. Who sequenced his own genome and released it to the world back in 2007? The DBC is more akin to the Wright brothers' first plane, rather than to the ultimate biological teleporter. And even if that never works out, revolutionizing how the world deals with viral outbreaks and ushering in a new era of on-site medicine wouldn't be a bad consolation prize. And maybe it would even be the new, what do they call it in Star Trek, where you could just make Earl Grey hot? It wasn't a teleporter. It could be a teleporter. But it's pretty interesting. So I guess we'll see. But Elon Musk and Craig Venter want to print life on Mars, terraforming Mars with synthetic biology, push a button, create life. It's exactly what the DARPA lady said. Musk doesn't want to print humans. Instead, he wants to print bacteria and other organisms that will eventually help us terraform Mars by using a digital biological converter, a DBC, developed by Craig Venter, that can take raw DNA code, implant it into a universal recipient cell, and bring it to life. I think biological teleportation, ding, is what is going to truly enable the colonization of Mars, Ventner told Ashley Vance, author of a new biography on Musk coming out on Tuesday. Elon and I have been talking about how this might play out, and eventually you'd need to heat Mars up if you want it to be an Earth-like planet, and I don't have a plan for that. But Ventner is well known for his work on the Human Genome Project, which, as the name suggests, was the first to sequence an entire human genome. He was also the first to create synthetic life by removing genetic code from within a bacteria and replacing it with a synthetic genome. And Ventner's genome printer would play more of a support role in this scenario, allowing humans to potentially print life that could survive outside whatever life support structure Musk would want to set up there. Vance notes that a DNA printer on Mars would allow humans to create medicines, food, and helpful microbes for early settlers of the planet. That's important because Musk himself told Vance that he thinks it's possible to create a self-sustaining Martian colony, but moving outside of enclosed greenhouses and other housing structures is a problem he hasn't tackled yet. If we ever want to live on Mars and not remain tethered to life support, we need to terraform it, he says. And eventually, you'd need to heat Mars up if you wanted it to be an Earth-like planet, and you don't have a plan for that, Musk says. There's zero chance of it being terraformed and Earth-like in my lifetime. Not zero, but 0.0001% chance. And you would have to take real drastic measures with Mars. Well, Ventner's digital biological converter is still a prototype, more or less, but it has backing from DARPA within the Department of Defense. And at the moment, it only prints DNA, but he hopes to one day have it spit out living cells. Ventner says the ink of this printer will be a universal recipient cell that can have any sort of DNA spliced to it and brought to life. If you solve the transport problem, it is not that hard to make a pressurized, transparent greenhouse to live in. Ventner intends digital biological converters to print living cells using an automated and improved version of the process behind his 2010 breakthrough synthetic cell. Work on that is currently underway, and with the focus and creating what he calls the universal recipient cell, a kind of biological blank slate to be able to receive any synthetic genome and make it come to life. Other work Ventner has been doing will allow for NASA and other scientists to send genetic code of something discovered on Mars back to Earth, where it could be printed in a laboratory in order to be studied. Oh my God, like teleporting Mars life to Earth. Having alien species be beamed back here and being recreated does sound like science fiction, but believe it or not, It is potentially real, says Ventnor to The Guardian. But there is no reason the same process wouldn't work the other way around, allowing someone at Musk's Martian colony to print some of Earth's extremophiles, which would hopefully be able to survive on Mars, and which would be able to, in theory, very, very slowly change the Martian landscape to one that is more hospitable for humans. Musk estimates it would take somewhere between a century and a millennium to terraform Mars. But in the meantime, early colonists would live in a controlled, closed environment. I think it is highly likely that there will be a self-sustaining Martian colony. There will be enough people interested who will sell their stuff on Earth and move, Musk says. You move, get a job there, make things work. If you solve the transport problem, it's not all that hard to make a pressurized, transparent greenhouse to live in. But if you can't get there in the first place, it does matter. So Musk, of course, is working on that part. And if he succeeds, maybe Ventnor will help him do the rest. So, I don't know, guys. Some pretty crazy stories today. Well, I hope everybody hangs out this weekend. I'm going to try and get as much new stuff on as I can. It's looking pretty good so far. Hope you enjoyed this week. Did a deep dive into AI, now printing life on Mars. And hopefully we can continue this on Monday. Everybody take care.
This is Ozzy Skateboard, and you're listening to You.